I've come to the conclusion that this legislation represents one of the serious, one of the most serious, if not the most serious attempt by a government to undermine the rights of disabled people in Australia.
Is there anything that you do like about the bill?
Is there anything that I do like about the bill? I think that,
Hi, I'm Dr. George Talaporis, and welcome to Loser Unnecessary, Australia's period podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Brought to you by the Summer Foundation, and coming to you from Wurundjeri Land, and pay my respects to the traditional owners, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, I chat with Senator Jordan Steele John to discuss the proposed changes to the NDIS Act that are currently before Parliament. Jordan explains why he is deeply concerned about the planned changes and explains what they might mean for the future of the NDIS and our lives. Check it out and please note, I have asked the Minister for the NDIS to come on the show, and I'm still hopeful that he will accept the invitation. Hey Jordan, welcome to the show.
Hello, George. Great to be back with you.
So good to have you on. Now, in case someone just landed from an entirely different planet, can you introduce yourself?
I absolutely can. My name is Jordan Steele John. I'm a Green Senator from Western Australia. I am the only disabled person that we know of so far.
You've been in the Senate for like almost 7 years now. Maybe you're like the youngest senator? Yep. Are you still the youngest? Or?
Well, I've just actually given up the title of the youngest, so I'm still the youngest to have been elected. But somebody was subsequently elected who is now, I think, 4 months younger than me. So I now am feeling the passage of time. George, at the grand old age of 29, you know, it's... Life takes a different pace.
Oh, it sure does. I'd love to hit for that, mate. We're here to focus today on the NDIS bill that's currently in Parliament. And like many of us, you probably spent a lot of time going through the bill. What are your overall impressions?
My impression of this bill is not good. And there's a lot to unpack with that, but I've spent a lot of time reading this legislation, George, trying to see the good in it, trying to come to it with generous assumptions, in the hope that so much of the desire for positive change that the disability community expressed at the election would be found somewhere in this legislation. And unfortunately, the longer I've looked at it and the more in detail I've analysed it and others have analysed it, the clearer it's become that this piece of legislation attempts to remove from disabled people our right to choice and control over the individualized supports that we need for our daily lives. It undermines our ability to exercise agency in our lives. It robs us of the protections that currently exist in relation to our ability to request for and argue for individualized supports. And if passed, would make it so much easier for the government and people in the NDIA to remove people from the scheme and reduce the supports that they are able to access. And none of those things at any point are things which the disability community have asked for, and yet, sadly, here they are in the legislation.
Isn't that the aim of this bill?
Well, when we're trying to find out the aim for any piece of legislation, the first step, in my experience, is to analyse the context in which the bill was created. So the context for this bill is that the senior members of this government, from the moment they were elected, the decision makers, the treasurer and the prime minister, and they are the two most senior roles in the government, along with the finance minister, have made it crystal clear that they believe providing supports to disabled people through the National Disability Insurance Scheme represents a financial burden to the bottom line, to the government, that they are unwilling to continue to bear. We saw this come to material practice when the government moved to place a sustainability framework around the NDIS, which constrained the amount of support the scheme could provide to people. And then we saw it again when the government refused to release the assumptions behind that sustainability framework so we could understand what it meant for disabled people that their government was intending to spend $74 billion less on providing us with supports than was previously intended. And at each step in that process, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer have made it clear that they are willing to push us off the scheme to reduce the supports that we receive. We have also had a 18-month period in which the government, kind of pretended to engage with the disability community in a process of consultation through a so-called independent review, which a lot of us invested a lot of time in and had a lot of hope for the outcome of that review. And yet, sadly, what we see in the recommendations of the review is a lot of what we've seen for the last 10 years from both sides of Parliament when it comes to the scheme, which is an attempt to reduce choice and control, make it harder for us to receive individualised, reasonable and necessary supports because of a belief that those things are, you know, nice to have, but our human rights of disabled people are just a bit too expensive at the moment. So we've had those things, those pieces of context, and then you see this bill come into the world, and key elements of it make it possible to enact that agenda. They make it possible to subject all people applying to the NDIS to a functional capacity assessment. They make it possible and in fact will create a mandatory system by which you will be subject to a needs assessment and not able to challenge the result of that needs assessment. And they grant huge powers to the agency and the minister and the government to constrain what we can request as a support, to remove supports we currently receive, and to decide on our behalf who it is best to deliver those supports. So if you take it in that kind of holistic, if you take it together in that way, it's actually really clear that this bill is the culmination of a goal that they've actually been pursuing since they came into government.
Is this proposal better or worse than what we saw from the previous government?
I would say that it is worse than what we saw from the previous government. Yes, I would say that. I have no doubt that the previous government intended to do many of the things that is within this legislation, that independent assessments was a kind of first step down a road where they would have ended at these other places. But if you take, for instance, the power being granted to employees of the NDIA, delegates of the NDIA, to request a participant undertake an additional assessment in order to provide additional information to support their continued presence as part of the scheme, which is granted to the agency in this bill. So basically, the delegate gets the power to say to you, George, go and undertake a occupational therapy assessment or a psychological assessment or any other assessment that they deem necessary. And if you don't complete that assessment and provide the details of that assessment to the agency within 90 days, then your access to the scheme can be revoked. That is a tool, if you like, that the Liberals never even considered placing formally in the independent assessments structure.
Let's go through some of the consensus. So changes for planning and budgets are huge. We've got assessments that are back and a new approach to determining reasonable and necessary.
Yep.
I'm interested, when you look at this, do you think that this will result in people's plans being better or worse?
Worse, much worse. Worse in a couple of key ways, because I think it's important to be as specific as we can so that people know what's going on. So they'll be worse in a few ways. They will be smaller. These changes will result in reductions of the amount of funding in people's plans, because the amount of funding in your plan will be based off your a calculation made after the completion of a so-called needs assessment. Now that needs assessment tool will fail to accurately reflect the specifics of your needs and life experience, because no assessment tool ever devised, or I would argue devisable, is able to reflect the individual context in which somebody lives, or the individual context in which they wish to live. And all of those things impact on how much funding is required to be able to support somebody to achieve their goals and to live in line with their basic human rights. And how do I know this? I know this because the original NDIS legislation was drafted in such a way as to avoid this attempt at a one-size-fits-all determination of funding, precisely because people understood that people's support needs vary so dramatically based on their impairment, their environment, and the goals that they have. So you will see, I think, less in your plan. You will be able to use your plan under this new framework in far fewer ways than you can now. Your choice and control as a participant will be radically constrained. You will no longer be able to make the case to the agency that a certain support is reasonable and necessary in your individualized circumstance. Because the entire concept of a reasonable and necessary support is being removed from the legislation and replaced by something called an NDIS support. And we can unpack a bit of what that means in a moment. But basically what that will mean is that there are far fewer things you will be able to be funded for. So you'll get less funding, you'll be able to use it in fewer ways to meet your needs, and ultimately you will experience more financial stress and emotional strain. Your independence will be reduced, and we will. There is a significant risk that we will go backwards rather than forwards in terms of our independence and engagement in the broader community as a group of people.
I want to talk about this change that is proposing to be in a definition of what an NDIS support years, and the government says this is a good thing because it will make it clearer to people what they can spend with the NDIS. And they also say that they've linked it with the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. What do you think of the proposed definition of NDIS supports?
So I think when looking through the bill, this was one of the sections that really makes me mad. Because it's for anybody following at home and you're a bit of a legislation nerd, you want to look at it yourself. The section we're referring to here is section 10, A, B, and C. And also, if you really want to get into the detail, modifications made to section 8. So these pieces together remove the concept of an individual, remove the concept of plans as containing reasonable and necessary supports. So they remove that in section 8, replace it with the idea of an NDIS support. In section 10, they then go to kind of define what an NDIS support is. And you're absolutely bang on. There's this section 10A is this collection of words drawn from the UNCRPD. Pretty mangled and oddly kind of cobbled together, that say things that, you know, most of us would agree with about, you know, those things which a disabled person should have to be able to live a life where their human rights are upheld. There is then, though, two subsequent clauses, B and C, which define an NDIS support as that which the NDIS defines in its rules to be appropriate for the cohort of person to which the applicant belongs, and also that the support is deemed to be not inappropriate for that same group of people. So basically, all of this means that an NDIS support is whatever the government of the day, because let's remember that, you know, the agency doesn't live independently, it's guided by the government. An NDIS support is whatever the government of the day decides it will be. And an NDIS support is not whatever the government of the day decides it to be. And it no longer matters whether you as an individual person in your individual circumstances would find this to be a reasonable and necessary support. If it's not in the rules, it's not something that you can have, regardless of your circumstance. So that's at a basic level what it is. What it does is it introduces massive uncertainty into the scheme, because regulatory rules, parliamentary rules, can be changed all the time. There's no limit on the amount of times they can be changed. Anybody listening that's on the DSP knows exactly how it felt when the impairment tables, which are also regulations, were radically revised by the Gillard government back in the day, and then further changed by the Abbott government in order to kick about 200,000 people off the DSP. That's what it actually looks like when you take this stuff and you put it in the regulations. So it is one of the most worrying elements of the legislation, because rather than a determination that your wheelchair or your support hours or the type of service you need is decided on a case-by-case basis, it's just whether it's in the rules for somebody with CP or somebody with Down syndrome or somebody with, you know, another condition.
What would you say to the government who is saying we want people to know what they can spend their money on? Would you say that there is a way of addressing that without impacting on person control? And an example that's been told to me is that some people, they mentioned that they can spend it on alcohol or on drugs. This is the stuff that, you know, people will use to argue for this. What do you say to them?
I say that those examples are really bloody offensive straw men arguments that should not be deployed by people in positions of power. This whole idea that we as disabled people are out there spending NDIS funds on alcohol and boats and all this nonsense is not founded in reality, right? If there is a need, and there has not been a demonstrated need to provide clearer guidance to participants, then the best thing the agency could do is more effectively and consistently communicate with disabled people in formats that were accessible to them. But to be quite honest with you, the problem with what is and is not approved as an NDIS support is not a problem created by disabled people. It is a problem created by agency staff and agency culture. The NDIS has always had the legislative framework needed to make individualized decisions in relation to specific participant needs. What it has never had is the culture or staffing levels necessary to implement that policy framework consistently, so that each individual disabled person participating in the planning process knows that they will get what they need, and the planner that's working with them will get them and will have read the bloody reports that we have submitted ahead of time, which is not what happens now. And that would deliver consistency of approach for participants and families. You would know that would be the agency's approach to you, and that the variation in the outcome, the planning outcome, is a reflection of the variation of participant need and context, rather than what we have now, which is wildly different outcomes spewed out of the agency because half the people in there aren't supported to read the reports properly, and all the people in there are under a deep cultural pressure to find every reason, any reason, to reduce people's supports. That is actually what we have now, and nothing in this bill solves that problem.
I'd like to talk about changes to the powers around how you can spend your funding. Can you explain to us? I understand there's going to be limits around social support providers for some people, changes around the sort of process that you need to follow before you can actually access a certain support for people who are wondering where that comes from. I think that's under section 32H.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that section?
That section 32H is I think one of the best examples of a common problem in this legislation and in the whole government's approach to the NDIS. So a common theme through the entire bill is the removal of rights and processes that are currently granted to disabled people who are participants and our families within the legislation. So they're protections and processes written down, the removal of those and the transfer of them into rules and ministerially determined methods which currently don't exist, and which the government are saying, basically, trust us. Trust us, give us the power to do almost anything, and trust that we won't use it in a way that makes your life more difficult. And disabled community would, I think, be right to respond to that by saying, no thanks, bro. I'll keep the rights and processes enshrined in the bill. Thank you very much. Particularly given the kind of the political context we discussed earlier. 32H is the worst example of that, because it basically grants the agency the power to define in any way it sees fit the types of services, supports, services and supports that can be provided under the NDIS, and the processes under which somebody will be able to access those different types of supports. It also sets up a framework where the agency can provide direct funding to particular providers, which is the gateway, I think, the kind of starting gun on a return to a block-funded model of NDIS supports that we've worked so hard to get away from in the last decade. So it's very, very broad. I've heard it described as like a bill within a bill. And one of the things it will enable is the agency deciding that, and the government deciding that for certain people, they are no longer allowed to engage the support worker or support workers that work for them, that they want to work with, that they have built a team alongside and have trust in. And this comes to the question of the ability to self-manage and utilize unregistered support workers. So it's got those implications, but it also has a number of other really worrying implications for every part of the scheme. Because what we have to remember, George, is when a bill transfers a power from legislation to delegated rules, what is occurring is a transfer of right, basically, of citizen rights from being enshrined in a piece of legislation to determined by a department. And people might, feel less worried about that process under a Labour government, for instance. I can understand why some people might think, that's maybe not so bad. But can we imagine together what that may mean for the NDIS under a Dutton prime ministership or however many right-wing governments might come after it? These are really, really significant powers of determination, and the only measure of transparency and the only opportunity that is granted for disabled people to object to the rules that may be made under these sections of the bill are to lobby their parliamentarians to vote down the rule in the Senate.
There was a recommendation in a review that I've been critical and sort of other advocates around funding people who need 24/7 support at a 1-to-3 ratio. I want your reaction to that, Jordan, because I am so bewildered by how that recommendation even made it to print. It's a breach of our human rights in so many ways. I'd like to get your take on it.
Oh, fury, George. I read the recommendation of the review it was over the Christmas holidays, and I was so angry by that recommendation, I had to just put it down and roll around for a bit to be able to read any more. And this is, again, this legislation will enable that recommendation to be enacted. And I think why it makes me so angry, it fundamentally will require people that require those supports to be grouped together as not a kind of, oh, well, that's the way some people live. And, the ridiculous arguments that are used to group people together now, oh, well, we don't have an explicit policy, but that's just how they end up. It takes that from a kind of cultural practice that is the outcome for far too many people and makes it the object of the NDIS to group people together in institutional settings. This embeds institutionalization into Australian law again, when the entire point of the NDIS was to end that, at the very moment when we've just got a Royal Commission report that speaks so clearly about the dangers of institutionalization and the driving role that plays in the violence, abuse, and neglect and exploitation that we experience. And if all that isn't enough to boil your blood, I just think it is outrageous that we as disabled people, because we have support needs, should be expected and in fact forced by legislation to live with people we don't know. Nobody else is required to do that. People house share, people in this housing crisis we're struggling through so profoundly in the entire community are practically economically forced to share housing with people they don't like. But that isn't the law of the land that those people have to live together. And yet this legislation in 2024 is proposing that the starting point for the reasonable and necessary test is that we, as disabled people, do have to live together, and will only be able to make a case as to whether that not happen if we have very high and complex support needs, whatever that turns out to be, and have dependent children. So we don't just get to decide that actually for a portion of our lives we want to just live independently on our home, in our own home, by ourselves. To say nothing of the fact that so many of us have experienced violent crime against us, of a sexual nature or other crime, that makes it terrifying to have to share your space with people you don't know, who you can't control whether they come in or come out. Like, it is so inappropriate, and it reveals the nonsense of the suggestion that what the government is proposing is being driven by a desire to keep disabled people safe. Because if that really was your goal, the very last thing you would do is write a piece of legislation that would enable you to force disabled people back into group home settings.
There are also changes around reviewing processes and how you can appeal decisions. Will it be harder or easier to appeal your NDIS plan budget as a result of those changes?
Harder, and in some cases impossible. They're probably one of the most impactful changes proposed in the bill is the introduction of a so-called needs assessment. And anybody that remembers the independent assessment fight against the government way back when will immediately have alarm bells ringing in your head whenever you hear the word assessment. Now, what a needs assessment is really, really important to understand. A needs assessment is the process that you go through after being granted access to the scheme to gather information as to your support needs. What it is in a specific sense has not been defined, because it will be decided in the rules. It's one of those things. But what is clear is, what is decided in the rules, is that once that assessment process has taken place, there will then be a method determined by the minister created to translate the data from the needs assessment into the budget outcome. And so therefore the assessment and what it says, what is recorded or ultimately concluded from your needs assessment, is directly linked then to how much funding you receive as a disabled person. And the legislation specifically exempts the outcome of the assessment, the needs-based assessment, from being appealed or taken to the AAT and challenged. You are not able to do that with the needs-based assessment. You are only able to potentially, if you're lucky, challenge the budgetary outcome of the assessment. What funding were you allocated? And then, in that situation, you are only able to challenge the total amount, because the bill shifts the reasonable and necessary test from the individual support item level, you know, your funding for support workers or wheelchairs or whatever, to the whole flexible budget, meaning that basically you will be having to argue with the agency over whether the total amount of funding is reasonable and necessary for you, rather than the absence or presence of the specific support that you need. And anybody who's on the scheme will understand immediately the risks that are created by that, because funding for a particular support can drive up the overall dollar value of a plan and mask the absence of other critically needed supports. And we deal with these cases all the time where people technically have, you know, tens of thousands of dollars left in their plan, but what they have run out of is critically needed supports for the actual thing that they need to live day to day. And the idea that the flex, oh, it'll all be one great big pot, so don't worry about it, but then that one great big pot will be drawn down on very quickly by the critically needed support that wasn't funded, because often they have different financial values. And so you'll burn through all of your funding, having a support worker help you out of bed, for instance, and won't have anything then left for your ability to participate in the community or the other things that you need. And the removal of the ability to argue at a kind of case-by-case basis, at an individual support item basis for your particular supports, means that it will be so much harder to challenge poor agency decision making, right at the very time where we are seeing more poor agency decision making than never before.
Is there anything that you do like about the bill?
Is there anything that I do like about the bill? I think that not that I've been able to find so far, but like, there was one thing that I thought I could like about the bill, because I mean, like, to be honest with you, George, and if people have made it to this point in the podcast, I can certainly imagine that you may have trouble believing this next statement, but just, you know, suspend your disbelief for a moment. I really didn't want to dislike this bill. I wanted to like it and to be able to support it. I wanted to be able, as so many disabled people wanted, to be able to support the recommendations of the independent review. Because I and so many people would actually just like the NDIS to be fixed, and then we could get on with dismantling all the other parts of ableism and discrimination that exist in society. My end goal is not to be fighting for the very existence of the NDIS as an idea forever and ever and ever. So, if I could have found a way to love it, I was really looking for it. And I thought I'd found it. I thought I'd found my one thing that I could love, which was the definitions of support guided by the UNCRPD. And, you know, the minister went to great lengths to say, you know, this is the first time in the history of Australia that we have written aspects of the UNCRPD into the law. But then you go and actually double check that what they've written in that section is actually what the CRPD says. And it's not. They've taken from different sections of the CRPD and like cherry picked them and bundle them together in a way that doesn't really fairly reflect what the particular sections of the convention say, or even the overall piece. So I couldn't even love that part, which is a shame.
Are there any final thoughts or words that you'd like to leave with our listeners, Jordan?
Yes. My final thoughts: I really understand that a lot of us in the community are tired. A lot of us are tired. A lot of us have been fighting for a very long time for the basics that we need to live, in a context of being extraordinarily worn down by COVID and the fear that created, by the constant grind of the poverty that we are confined to, the ableism that we are subjected to. And I also really understand that in that headspace, and I confront this sometimes too, you know, in that headspace, there's a desire to go, oh, well, I just don't think that we can push back on this anymore. And, you know, there's a voice in your head, there's a feeling of, there can be at times a feeling of, you know, the Liberals want to cut this scheme and change it. Labour want to do these things to it too. A lot of people in the media are saying that, you know, that needs to be done. This is inevitable. We might as well just accept the best version of it as we can get and hope that you know, through the co-design process and the consultation process, that things will be okay. And I deeply understand the desire to believe that. And yet, through reading this legislation, through reading the review, I've come to the conclusion that this legislation represents one of the most serious, if not the most serious attempt by a government to undermine the rights of disabled people in Australia. And I have also concluded that if it passes as it is currently written, it will supercharge so many of the things that we are experiencing about the NDIS, that are bad. The extent and the ease that we are kicked off it, the constant battle around appropriate funding, the cuts that we have to somehow make work, the uncertainty with which we live day to day as to whether the new planner or the new delegate will change their mind and not read the paperwork. All of these things are at significant risk of getting so much worse under this piece of legislation. And so together, we have to push back. And even though many of us are tired, together we have strength. Together we are powerful. To be a disabled person in Australia is to live a life often of systems failing you and trying to dehumanize you. And in the face of that reality, we persevere. And this is a moment for us together, once again, to chuck our arms around each other, metaphorically or physically, and to rise together and to campaign together and to be bolshy together and to be annoying together and to be disliked together and to push and to keep pushing, not only until this bill is chucked in the bin, but until we get the legislative changes and the cultural changes that are actually needed. And we can do it. Together we can do it. We did it with independent assessments. We can do it again. We can leverage our power as political citizens of this country, all 4.4 million of us, all 640,000 participants and our family. So many of us are more connected than we've ever been before, and millions of us vote. And with those pieces of knowledge in my head, I feel my tiredness, and I feel the sense of grinding frustration that sat in the pit of my stomach when you finish reading this bill begin to transform into the angry energy that drives a Bolshe campaign and hope that we can, in fact, kick this bill in the dust and get the changes that we need to fix our NDIS.
So that is not an incredibly valued representative for us in the parliament. We're very lucky to have you there waving the disability flag. It means a lot to all of us that you do what you do. I want to say thank you. And also say that people can have their say, that you're involved in a Senate inquiry right now. So if people want to have their say, they can get involved. I'll have a description for how to have your say in the field below. And hopefully people will make sure that the Parliament hears our concerns and understands what's needed in order to ensure that we having a diocese that meets the needs of our community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jordan, thank you for the work that you do and for the conversations that you engage in and the spaces that you occupy. And I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for coming on the show, Jordan. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks so much, Jordan. See ya.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Visual and Necessary. If anything that we've discussed today has raised issues for you, please seek out support, and if you need it, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts in the comments section, and thank you so much for listening. Until next time, stay well and reasonable.